I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Here and Now. A major speech today on the economy from Barack Obama, with more grim economic news as a deep recession enters its second year. Retailers reported dismal sales for the month of December. The number of people seeking unemployment benefits continues to rise sharply, according to the government, while employers continue to shed jobs. The Congressional Budget Office projects a record $1.2 trillion budget deficit this year, and that doesn't include the cost of an economic stimulus package expected to reach $800 billion. Add to those facts and figures the collapse of the housing market, a global credit crunch, and the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, and you get a sense of the scope of the challenge facing the president-elect. In his first speech since his election, Mr. Obama said today the current crisis could worsen without dramatic action by Washington. He offered few new details about his proposed stimulus package, but he said there's no time to lose.
This plan must begin today. A plan I'm confident will save or create at least 3 million jobs over the next few years. It's not just another public works program. It's a plan that recognizes both the paradox and promise of this moment. The fact that there are millions of Americans trying to find work, even as all around the country there's so much work to be done. And that's why we'll invest in priorities like energy and education, health care, and a new infrastructure that are necessary to keep us strong and competitive in the 21st century.
President-elect Barack Obama speaking earlier today at George Mason University outside of Washington, D.C. Joining us now is Robert J. Samuelson. He's an economic columnist for The Washington Post and Newsweek and author of The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past and Future of American Affluence. And he followed Obama's speech today. And Robert, good to have you.
Nice to be with you.
Yeah, this is basically an infrastructure spending and tax relief proposal. Take us through the major points. What did you hear today?
Well, first, we don't know what's in this program. I mean, we've had various leaks. We don't know whether the total program is going to be $675 billion or $800 billion. So it'll probably be stretched over 2 years. It's clear that there will be a substantial chunk of tax relief, both on policy grounds and political grounds, to attract Republicans. In the speech, Obama repeated the fact that most working families will get a $1,000 tax cut, which is a proposal he made in the campaign. Single workers would probably get $500. There'll be some cutoff point, probably around $200,000 for that. But in terms of exactly what's in the package, we don't know.
We're still waiting to hear some details about that. He said only government can muster the kind of resources to respond to the current crisis. Is he right about that, at least in the short term?
Well, I think most economists believe that because most of the rest of the economy is already in decline, that the government needs to kind of provide demand where consumers and businesses, in terms of a new investment in housing, is not providing demand. And we're not getting much demand now from exports because the rest of the world is in recession, too. So you ask yourself, if it can't come from consumers and it can't come from business or housing or exports, where will it come from? And the only answer is that, at least in the short term, the government needs to provide some demand. That's the theory.
Mm. I was struck by this. Although Obama didn't offer as many specifics as he might have about how much this will cost and precisely where the money would go, he was very blunt about the scope of the problem. I think he used language that I hadn't heard yet. I mean, calling the current challenge a crisis unlike any we have seen in our lifetime. Do you think it's important to cast it as such, for the president-elect to cast it as such?
Well, he has clearly painted this situation in the most dire possible terms. And without using the word depression, he is suggesting that we could be on the verge of something like a depression. And so the obvious attempt here is to scare Congress, it seems to me, into passing his proposal fairly quickly without very many major modifications.
Okay, well, thanks so much for talking to us today. That's Robert Samuelson, economic columnist for Newsweek and The Washington Post. As part of the proposed stimulus package, Obama is also calling for immediate relief to states, workers, and families who are bearing the brunt of the bad economy.
To get people spending again, 95% of working families will receive a $1,000 tax cut. The first stage of a middle-class tax cut that I promised during the campaign and will include in our next budget. To help Americans who have lost their jobs and can't find new ones, We'll continue the bipartisan extension of unemployment insurance and health care coverage to help them through this crisis.
Arguably nowhere is an economic recovery more needed than in the state of Michigan. In November, Michigan had the nation's highest jobless rate at nearly 10%. That's expected to rise as the auto industry continues to struggle. We turn now to Darrell Buchanan. He's city administrator in Flint, Michigan, which has become a poster child for the struggling auto industry and indeed economic distress in general. Last month, he joined leaders from other cities in lobbying Congress to give automakers an emergency bridge loan. And hello, Mr. Buchanan.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Tell me what you heard. Were you encouraged what you heard today from the president-elect?
I was very encouraged by when he talked about putting money in people's hands, the ones who truly need it. And I was greatly impressed when he talked about helping states preserve police and fire levels in varying communities. Because you know when an economic crisis hits, public safety has to take a hit also. But if the federal government can bring in money that will allow municipalities to sustain the police and fire levels, it can only help.
Mm.
And when he talked about extending unemployment benefits and health care, with the layoff that have hit Flint and Michigan, that can only bring a smile to many people's faces that have been laid off in my community and throughout the state.
Give us a sense of what Flint is facing. I'm reading that you've had to lay off city workers, including 45 police officers, correct?
We have. What Flint has done is no different than what other major corporations have done throughout America. When revenues are declining in a community or in the corporate world, you have to make tough decisions. And some of those tough decisions have been police personnel and other employees throughout the city of Flint. Mayor Williamson, he is one of the foremost leaders on infrastructure improvements throughout the country. People need to come to Flint and see some of the activities that the mayor has implemented to the sidewalk program, where he used block grant monies to improve sidewalks in specific census tracts. Mayor Williamson has a program and the personnel that's ready and available to assist the President-elect Obama in his initiatives to revitalize the struggling national economy and struggling municipal economy.
Mm. What else would you have liked to heard? You're encouraged by what you did hear,
yes,
including help for municipalities so that they don't have to lay off police officers and firefighters. What else specifically would you have liked to have heard, or what do you want to hear going forward, I guess, from Washington?
I was truly impressed also when he talked about helping teachers and enhancing the educational environment, because as the deficit for the nation approaches $1.2 trillion, the individuals that will pay this back at present aren't receiving the education necessary to compete in a global economy.
Hmm. And aside from auto jobs, let me ask you about the future of Flint. The New York Times reports today about how the city of Pittsburgh, for example, turned itself around with high-tech and biotech jobs after the steel industry collapsed.
Yes.
Can something like that happen in Michigan? Does it have to happen in a city like Flint? And how could Washington help?
It's already occurring. Alternative energy plants and research teams are at Kettering University, and the governor has helped create alternative energy and wind turbine industry in this community. We have five colleges in Genesee County, the University of Michigan, Flint. We have Kettering University. If the government can put money into those institutions to bring more high-quality students here, your economy will have to diversify, because those types of individuals need a diverse economy. We have Channel 5 that's moved downtown. The Mayor Williamson has University Avenue stretching from the U of M to Kettering University. We have engineering firms that have moved into downtown Flint.
Hmm.
We have small businesses. We are turning it around.
Well, it's good to hear a note of optimism coming from the city of Flint. Darrell Buchanan, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Obama's election gave us hope for the country. The election of Mayor Don Williamson gave us hope for this community. And you need to come to Flint and see the types of initiatives Mayor Williamson has put forth.
All right, we'll do that, sir. Thank you very much. Darrell Buchanan, City Administrator in Flint, Michigan. We turn now to Stuart Altman, Professor of National Health Policy at Brandeis University's Heller School. He served in the Nixon, Ford, and Clinton White Houses and helped candidate Barack Obama craft his health policy. And Stuart Altman, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
First of all, your reaction to what you heard from the president today. What struck you the most?
Well, obviously, I'm very supportive of the need for the federal government to come in at this time. As an old-line Keynesian economist, I believe that there is no alternative at this point for the federal government to be the source of generating the funding. In my particular area, I'm most encouraged by his recognition that we badly need the federal government to help states support their safety net programs, both in health care and unemployment insurance, as well as to do jobs.
Mm. Let me talk to you about the issue of entitlements. As Obama commits to a massive amount of spending to jumpstart the economy, he's also said that reforming entitlement programs has to be a big part of controlling spending. He said that as recently as yesterday. Social Security, Medicare traditionally have been the third rail in politics. Touch them and you die. Can he do it, and does he need to do it?
Well, I mean, I think the dealing with the entitlement program is a very different issue, and it's a much more complicated than pumping money into the states and allowing them to expand their Medicaid program. I served on President Clinton's bipartisan commission. Trying to turn that ship around will be difficult, and I'm optimistic that he will try and that there are things that we could do. But at the end of the day, we really badly need our Social Security and Medicare programs to maintain their strength. And so I don't think he would propose the kinds of changes that were being recommended in the previous administration. So, yes, I'm encouraged that we need to look at it hard, because if we don't, it will go broke. Mm. But I'm hopeful also that it won't be a slash and burn type proposal that had been suggested in the past.
Mm. Now, we mentioned that you helped Senator and presidential candidate Obama write his health care policy. He's promised health care reform, universal access, or getting close to universal access. But given the current crisis and the huge scope of competing demands, can he make good on that promise?
Actually, I think that this is an opportunity we have not seen since the Great Depression in terms of reforming our healthcare system, and quite the opposite. It's the economic meltdown that is going to be the catalyst, because if we don't do something, we're going to find that even if people have their jobs, they're going to have their jobs without health insurance, because employers will just cut back on that as a kind of a fringe that they can't afford. So no, I think that the current economic problem is going to be a stimulus for healthcare reform, not be a detriment.
Okay, well, Stuart Altman, thanks so much for joining us today and offering your perspective. It's much appreciated.
My pleasure.
That's Stuart Altman. He's professor of national health policy at Brandeis University's Heller School. Altman also served in the Nixon, Ford, and Clinton White Houses and helped candidate Barack Obama craft his health care policy. Just ahead, a conversation with Boston University professor Andrew Bacevich about the lessons President-elect Obama should learn from the conflict in Gaza. And later in the show, a debate about allowing gays and lesbians to adopt. It's Here and Now. Israel's military operation in Gaza is a reminder of the immensely complicated and so far intractable conflict in the Middle East. As Israeli soldiers consolidate their hold on Gaza, militants in Lebanon are now firing rockets into northern Israel. Our next guest says the current crisis offers important lessons for the U.S. and for President-elect Obama as he prepares to assume office. Andrew Bacevich is a professor of history and international relations at Boston University and a retired Army colonel. His most recent book is The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism. And, Professor, welcome.
Thank you very much.
In your op-ed today in the Boston Globe, you suggest, first of all, that the current Israeli operation is a tacit admission of strategic failure. Can you explain that?
Sure. This conflict has provoked an enormous amount of commentary and controversy. It seems to me most of the argument really deals with moral issues, you know, whether the Israelis are right or wrong. I was trying to get at a different question, and that is whether or not the Israelis are smart, strategically smart, in what they're doing. And I think to ask that question yields very important lessons for the United States. Mm. In essence, what I'm arguing is that for the last four decades, they've been wrestling with what to do with the Palestinians. And my argument is that the incursion into Gaza ongoing right now is evidence of a massive strategic failure that really extends over the last four decades, and that has much to teach us.
And let's talk about that. What does it teach us? You say this holds important lessons for the U.S., that this conflict, Israel's conflict with Hamas and with the Palestinian issue in general, mirrors, in a way, America's struggle against radical Islam.
I think it's not unfair to suggest that the global war on terror, which is this struggle with violent radical Islam, really we are undertaking on a much larger scale what the Israelis have been trying to do with the Palestinians. And I'm sorry to say that for the past 7 years, we have been employing methods comparable to the methods that the Israelis have relied on.
Those methods being occupation, foreign invasion, that kind of thing.
Exactly right. I mean, to believe that because you possess superior military power, and certainly the Israelis have that and we have that, to believe that because you have that, you can rely on intervention and occupation to get other people to behave the way you want them to behave. That's what we are attempting to do in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I believe that in a much broader sense, that's what at least the Bush administration has intended to do across the Islamic world. If we look at the results that the Israelis have achieved in their 40-year effort to pacify the Palestinians, it seems to me that the evidence would suggest that just as they have not succeeded, we also are unlikely to succeed.
Let me just stop you there just to ask you this, though. Is there a difference in that Israel, much smaller country, obviously, surrounded by states, hostile in many ways to its very survival? Doesn't that give us choices, perhaps, that Israel doesn't have?
I think you're putting your finger on a very, very important point. The Israelis live next to their problem. To the extent that we share a similar problem, for us, the problem is far, far away. Even if you want to accept the argument, many people will not accept it, but even if you want to accept the argument that, in a sense, the Israelis have no choice but to try to use force to deal with the Palestinian problem, we ourselves do have choices. Mm. And I believe that thinking of this in a strategic context, we should exercise those choices. We should not simply blindly use the same kind of methods that the Israelis have employed for the past 40 years, because again, in my judgment, the evidence of the last 7 years suggests that going down that path is not going to produce success for us any more than it has for the Israelis. So the issue, the argument here is not a moral one. The argument is a strategic one, and I think it's something that the people in the Obama administration really ought to examine.
And how do you think they're doing so far? I mean, of course, the administration is not in power yet, but President-elect Obama, candidate Obama, talked about winding down Iraq and recommitting to Afghanistan.
To my mind, that suggests that they really haven't learned the right lessons. I mean, I'm very much concerned with this notion that, you know, sending another 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan is going to turn that around. I'm frankly not one of those who signs up to the notion that we have won the Iraq war. We've managed to reduce the level of violence, but our commitment there remains, and the drain on our resources continues to be an enormous one. So it just seems to me that the Gaza experience has a tremendous amount to teach us if we're willing to sort of examine the episode not through the lens of morality. I'm not saying one shouldn't look through that lens, but rather look at it through the lens of strategic effectiveness.
Well, so if you could give a sort of one page of bullet points to the incoming administration, the incoming Obama administration, in terms of what they should do based on these lessons, what would be the top two or three bullet points?
Well, I think it's, unfortunately, the lessons of Gaza are almost entirely negative lessons. In other words, the lessons are what you should not do.
Right.
Strategically, I believe that rather than trying to use our hard power to change the Islamic world, that we should examine the possibility of using our power to contain the threat posed by violent Islamic radicalism, and then to some degree rely on soft power to try to induce within the Islamic world the sorts of changes that might make it easier for us to live with people in something that approaches harmony.
Sure. Finally, we just heard today President-elect Obama's big speech on the economy. Are you concerned that with the economy so bad and requiring such immediate attention, that foreign policy and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan will not get the attention that they deserve in the months ahead, the months and years ahead?
It seems to me that, in a sense, when you run out of money, which is what's happening to us, sometimes that can have the very useful effect of causing you to challenge your assumptions, to consider courses of action that may previously have seemed to be unrealistic. So perhaps the fact that the economy is under such severe stress might actually promote an atmosphere in which rethinking strategy will become more possible.
That's Andrew Bacevich. He's a professor of history and international relations at Boston University and a retired Army colonel. There's more ahead. Stay with us. We'll be back after the news here and now. I'm Anthony Brooks. It's Here and Now. The American Civil Liberties Union has filed suit in Arkansas, challenging a new state law that effectively bans gays and lesbians from adopting. The ACLU says the law violates the state's legal responsibility to put the best interest of children above all else. We're going to spend a few minutes now talking about gay adoption around the country. In a minute, we'll hear from an opponent of same-sex adoption and from a gay adoptive father. But first, we turn to Adam Pertman, who joins us here in the studio. He's executive director of the Evan B. Donaldson Institute, which published recommendations in favor of gay and lesbian adoption. And Adam, your report says there are tens of thousands of children in foster care in need of adoptive homes, and that there's a shortage of willing adoptive parents. So put this into context for us and how it all relates to the debate over same-sex adoption.
Sure. What we looked at was the population of children who need homes, and are there enough people to give these kids homes? If there aren't, where do we find qualified parents for them? And one of the many populations where we need to look is gays and lesbians who want to be parents.
Now, same-sex adoption is governed by state law, and it varies across the country. Do most states allow gays and lesbians to
Absolutely.
Adopt?
Most states allow gays and lesbians to adopt, and they allow them to be foster parents. Florida is the only state that explicitly in law says if you are gay, you cannot adopt.
But other states will say you have to be married.
Utah had that state, and now Arkansas joins that line.
In that Arkansas case that we mentioned, the state presented experts, and they argued, and I'm sure you're familiar with these arguments, that there was a higher incidence of drug and alcohol abuse among same-sex couples, that their relationships were less stable than those of heterosexuals, and that their children suffered a societal stigma. What does your organization say to those arguments?
Well, we did a research project 2-3 years ago on precisely this question, and the research is very clear that gays and lesbians make perfectly good parents, and almost every major medical, psychiatric, pediatric, research-based organization in our country, I think 13 in all, have said that they find no evidence of any harm to children being raised by gays and lesbians, and that they seem to thrive just as well.
Well, we mentioned that challenge to the Arkansas law. Last November, a Florida law banning gay adoption was ruled unconstitutional. So is there a consensus building around the state? Around the country? It sounds like there is.
Well, the consensus, the Florida situation is more murky, but the consensus around the United States is really in practice. On the ground, the vast majority of adoption agencies do place children with gays and lesbians. So as we're having this legal debate in just a handful of states, in fact, on the ground, these families are being formed every single day.
As you've mentioned, your report comes down in favor of same-sex adoption because you say it's good for the kids. But there's also an economic cost to excluding same-sex couples from adopting, right?
That's absolutely right. Just out of foster care alone, between $3 and $6 billion is saved every year by placing kids in permanent adoptive homes. So when you take almost any percentage, and I think the percentage right now is around 4%, But when you take any percentage of that and say we're saving the money on foster care, but most important, we're giving these kids a shot in life. Kids who wind up aging out of foster care, usually at the age of 18, have a phenomenally higher percentage risk of winding up homeless, pregnant, in jail. And it's hard to imagine somebody saying, well, this little girl is better off in her seventh placement in 9 years of life in temporary care than in a loving home with two moms. Hard to imagine that someone is going to make that choice willingly.
Adam Pertman is executive director of the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute. Thanks, Adam, for coming in.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
For a different perspective, we turn now to Jerry Cox. He's president of the Family Council of Arkansas, which campaigned for the ballot initiative that effectively banned same-sex adoption in Arkansas. Voters approved it in November, and now the ACLU is challenging it in court. And Jerry Cox, welcome.
Glad to be with you.
Now, we've just heard from Adam Pertman, who argues that gay and lesbian adoption is in the best interest of the tens of thousands of children in need of adoptive homes. You disagree. Why?
Well, it's actually not in the best interest of those children. What these groups are focusing on is the rights of adults. And we've never written adoption laws in this country with the rights of adults in mind. We write those laws with the rights and welfare of children in mind.
But let me just stop you there, because we just heard Adam Pertman, and he cites years of research that children fare just as well with gay and lesbian parents as they do with heterosexuals.
There is no such research. In fact, 5,000 years of human history, all the major world religions, and just plain common sense, all tell us that a married home is the best place for a child to grow up. Children are healthier. They're more emotionally adjusted. All you have to do is ask any school teacher, ask any law enforcement person, ask any social worker, what's the best place for a child? And they will tell you that it's with a married mother and father.
And I respect your view on that, but isn't this really about what you think about gays and lesbians rather than what you think is in the best interest of all these kids that need adoptive homes?
No.
Well, then why deny these kids loving homes when there aren't enough willing adoptive parents as it is?
Well, there are plenty of adoptive parents out there. Where the bottleneck occurs is with the bureaucracy with state governments. We have people all over America, they're paying extra money to be able to go to places like Guatemala or Peru or places in Europe, Eastern Europe, and adopt children just because the bureaucracy is so bad here in this country. And so the adoptive parents are out there. The other thing is, people say that all a child needs is love, but they also need stability, they need discipline, they need a number of other things that a married home provides that these other homes simply cannot provide. If the state of Arkansas or any other state is going to create families, then why wouldn't we try to create the best one possible for each child?
Well, let me just ask you this. You've advocated for an adoption policy that puts restrictions on unmarried couples and effectively prevents gays and homosexuals from adopting. Yet there are tens of thousands of kids out there that need adoptive homes. If we take gay and lesbian families out of the mix, what is your recommendation for finding homes for all these kids?
Well, for one thing, we need to ramp up our efforts on the part of social services to go out and recruit good homes for these children. I'll bet you if you go to your state, my state, any other state, you'll find that most of these social workers sit in their offices waiting for someone to come in and wade through all the bureaucracy that's required for a person to be approved to be an adoptive parent. And so the good homes are out there. It's just a matter of going out and finding them. And see, to say that same-sex homes are just as good as heterosexual homes is saying that either a mother is not necessary or a father is not necessary. And we believe that both are necessary for the healthy development of children. That's the way it's always been. And again, you look at common sense, you look at the major world religions, you look at all of human history, and it all points to the fact that this is the best arrangement. And if it is, then why wouldn't we strive for that?
That's Jerry Cox. He's president of the Family Council of Arkansas. His organization campaigned for a ballot initiative that effectively banned same-sex adoption in Arkansas. Voters passed it in November, and it's now being challenged by the ACLU. Well, Mr. Cox, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Have a good day.
You too. Despite efforts to restrict gay and lesbians from adopting in a handful of places like Arkansas, it's taking place in the vast majority of states. Research from the Urban Institute finds about 65,000 children being raised by gay and lesbian parents. Among them is Dennis Patrick, a communications professor at Eastern Michigan University in Ypsilanti, Michigan. He lives with his partner, Tom, and their four adopted boys and one foster son who they're in the process of adopting as well. So, Dennis, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
So you've been right in the middle of this issue over gay adoption. Tell us what you and your partner had to go through when you adopted your first son.
Well, initially we had to find a foster care and adoption agency. So the first agency we went to was affiliated with the Catholic Church, and we asked if it would be a problem if we were a same-sex couple, and we were told that it was not. So we went to the orientation, we went through 12 hours of training, we got letters of reference put together, and then we reached the point where we were going to do a home study, and we were told that they weren't going to license us because we were a same-sex couple. And that was really frustrating because we had just been told, you know, how great a need there was for foster parents here in the state of Michigan and how we would get kids pretty quickly after we got our license. But it turns out there was some miscommunication where the licensing worker thought it was okay to license a same-sex couple, but the director of the agency was adamantly opposed to it.
Well, since that experience, I understand you found an agency that's receptive to your being a parent. But I want to ask you, you and your partner also act as emergency foster parents. Has that ever been complicated by the fact that you're gay?
No, not really. We like the kids to know that we're a gay couple before they come stay with us. Sometimes it's not always possible because a child might come into care at like 11 o'clock at night. And so the important thing is just to get them here and make sure they're okay and make sure they have a place to sleep and something to eat. But most kids, when they find out, it's no big deal to them. It's like they're gay. Oh, okay. What kind of video games do they have? You know, do they have a dog? I mean, those are the things that they seem to be more concerned about rather than our relationship or our orientation.
Wow. Now, sometimes resistance to gay and lesbian adoption comes from the biological parents who don't want their kids placed in same-sex household. You encountered that issue at one point, didn't you?
Yes, we did. We had a birth mother, actually, of our son Paul, who's now adopted, who was opposed to having Paul with us when she found out we were gay. She actually contacted her attorney and had him request an emergency hearing in front of the judge to have her son removed from her home. But the agency spoke out in our defense. They said that Paul was doing great here, and the judge decided that it was in his best interest for our son to stay here and not be moved to a new home. Since then, after his mom got to know us, she made the decision to voluntarily terminate her parental rights with the hope and the request that Paul stay with us and be adopted by us.
So it sounds like she had quite a change of heart. But how has it been working for your kids? Do they face any issues around coming from an alternative family with other kids at school, for instance?
Yeah, no, the schools and teachers, pediatricians, they've all been really supportive. We're very upfront at the beginning about our family and what we're like. And so, for example, when we get a chance to request a teacher at the beginning of the school year, you know, we always ask that they find a teacher who, you know, is understanding and accepting of families like ours.
You know, finally, we've been talking about your experience as an adoptive parent. Prior to this conversation, we heard a bit of a debate around this issue. So I want to sort of give you a shot at sort of chiming in on this debate, and I obviously understand which side you come out on, but what do you say to the people who still maintain that the best home environment for adopted kids is in a family with a mom and a dad?
I think the best home environment for kids in general is a home with loving parents. And there are so many kids out there in foster care who are waiting for permanent families, and many of them would be perfectly happy with gay or lesbian parents. Some of them would not. That's okay. Then they need to find another family for that child that would be a better fit. But some of them who are waiting to be adopted would love to have a family with gay or lesbian parents. So I think we should be doing everything we can to help get those kids into homes. To me, that every child deserves a family. And there are LGBT families that, you know, would make great parents.
That's Dennis Patrick. He's a communications professor at Eastern Michigan University, and he's been speaking with us about his experience adopting four sons with his partner, Tom. All right, Dennis, thanks so much for talking to us today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
They say what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, but that's not the case this week at the 42nd International Consumer Electronics Show. The CES, as it's known, helps determine what gadgets you see on the store shelves as early as this weekend. Companies are unveiling HD screens as thin as a piece of paper and laptops so small they barely cover your lap, hoping to wow the media and eventually you. So joining us from the Sands Expo Convention Center in Las Vegas is freelance technology reporter Jeff Cutler. And how you doing, Jeff?
I'm fine, Anthony. How are you?
So let's talk about some of these cool gadgets. But first, give us some background on this show. Who attends? Who's there and why?
Well, CES is a trade event. So you have the press here, and then you have companies that want to sell the technology that's introduced during the show. And attendance is down a little bit this year, but with 140,000 people attending, you can't tell that it's down that much. And even with the economic issues in mind, people have to attend because it's the best place to find out what the next technology is.
Cool. Okay, well, let's talk about what you've seen so far. What strikes you?
The stuff that caught my eye were a lot of home and office gadgets or technology that makes life easier. The Neat company has come out with a line of scanners that actually process your receipts and anything that you scan into it using their software. This software can be used on any scanner, and they say they save time. And the hidden feature is that they can also process online receipts. So if you buy something online, you can process your Amazon receipt without even printing out any paper. So that makes it a green gadget as well.
Wow. So what else? Have you seen anything that can make my technological life a little more manageable, for example?
Well, I'm assuming you have a cell phone or an iPhone or a BlackBerry or some sort of gadget, maybe even an iPod.
Sure.
And what do you do when you go home? You pull the thing out of your pocket and look for the charger. Well, a company called PowerMat has brought out a charging device called their PowerMat that you just drop your devices onto and they charge.
Wow.
And
so it's a mat that's actually plugged into the wall?
Yeah, it's a mat you just plug into the wall and drop your device on it. And each device you put a specific receiver on the back of. So once that's done, all you do is put your phone down, put your BlackBerry down, your iPod. You can even put your laptop on it because there are receivers for the back of laptops. And it'll charge up to 6 devices.
So that's home tech. What about personal technology? What stands out there as fun in the personal tech field?
I think this is the first CES event that I have been bombarded by headphones. Everyone's bringing out a different type of headphone. And the neatest one I've seen so far is put out by a company called iFrogs. What they allow you to do is go online and design the look, not the innards of the headphone, but design the look all the way from the headband to the earpieces to the colors and designs on the sides. And another item that caught my eye was 3M has brought out some privacy film for your personal gadgets. And where everyone's going around today doing their own banking, sending emails, doing instant messages, 3M has created this film, which is fairly thin and can be applied to any device, that keeps people's prying eyes from looking over your shoulder at your banking information, your passwords, your emails to loved ones. And it's amazing because if you sit directly in front of it, you can see the screen. But even if you're off a few degrees, say you and I were sitting shoulder to shoulder, you wouldn't be able to read what was on my device.
So it sounds like, I'm struck by this, a lot of the stuff you're describing are accessories for devices that many of us already have. Do I have that right? That seems to be a big part of what's on offer there.
You do have that right. And a figure I heard was that for about every $3 spent on a personal audio device or a personal gadget, people are spending $1 on the accessories. So it makes sense for a company to just bring out accessories because you're making a third of what the share is out there.
So, Jeff, what's the one new product at the show, if there is just one product that really excites you, that makes you drool, that you feel like, you know, you got to have it right now?
I would want to get a netbook.
A netbook.
It's a notebook computer that has been pared down so that it's very efficient for going online, surfing the internet, sending email, and doing very light word processing. It's very portable, and it fits the lifestyle of a lot of people right now.
And how is this different than a BlackBerry or an iPhone, for example?
Well, it adds the functionality of having a keypad, so it's a little more robust. You can work with documents, and you can connect anywhere that there's wireless connectivity. The other thing is that these were developed as a result of the $100 laptop program that came out a couple years ago. They were trying to send affordable laptops to developing countries and have every kid have a laptop. And the manufacturers of those figured that here in the U.S., people are on the go so much they don't want to carry a 7-pound notebook. These things weigh right around 2 pounds. You can get them for $200 to $500. They have solid-state hard drives, which means that the hard drive just, it zips up. It doesn't have a spinning disk for some of them. It's just a flash memory that is instant on.
Fantastic. Jeff, let's talk about the economy a little bit. Consumer spending, obviously, way down. What's the mood there at this year's Consumer Electronics Show?
There's always a mix of emotions because people have spent a year or years bringing a product to market and they don't know how it's going to be received and what's going to happen. But the saving grace, ironically, for the economic problem that we're facing in the U.S. is that people are starting to nest and cocoon and spend more time at home. And the products that we're seeing here are making the time that people spend at home more comfortable. So even though people are saving money by not traveling or not going out to different events, they're spending some money and spending their budgets on technology and gadgets that are going to make their home life a little more convenient, fun, and entertaining.
So a little bit of reason for some optimism out there. Well, Jeff, thanks so much for talking to us today. I appreciate it.
Oh, don't mention it. It was great, Anthony.
That's Jeff Cutler. He's a freelance technology reporter speaking with us from this year's Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, Nevada. And finally today, here's a question for listeners everywhere, except perhaps in Ohio. If I told you that the county seat of Allen County, Ohio, is named for the capital of Peru, how would you pronounce it? You might be forgiven if you said Lima, as I did earlier this week when we welcomed our new listeners from WGLE in Ohio. It's spelled L-I-M-A, Lima, right? Wrong. It turns out, mistakes were made. And here to put them right is Patricia Smith, director of the Allen County Museum in Ohio. And Pat, it's Lima, Peru, but your town is pronounced how?
Lima.
Lima, of course.
Lima as like the bean.
Like a lima bean. So any particular reason the town's pronounced in this way?
We have sort of this legend, and some of it is actually written in some of our local histories, that the early founders gathered together in a cabin and threw names into a hat, and the very last piece of paper to be pulled out had the name L-I-M-A on it. Supposedly it was attributed to a man named Patrick Good. He apparently picked the name from a crate that had been shipped from Lima, Peru, and so it was stamped with that name.
I see.
In the crate was quinine from Peru and was used extensively in northwest Ohio to combat malaria in the early years when it was very swampy here. So he always seemed to insist on calling the town Lima after the name was adopted, but everyone else called it Lima.
So it sounds like we really don't know exactly why it's pronounced Lima.
No, I'm just guessing that it was a little bit of a corruption. It's sort of fun sometimes to look at names in other places. There's a little town not too far from Lima, and it's spelled R-U-S-S-I-A.
Russia.
But it's pronounced Rushi. So you don't have to go very far from Lima to see this kind of pronunciation issue going on. And I'm guessing that the same thing exists in every state of the United States.
I think you're right. And Patricia Smith, thanks so much for putting us straight. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
That's Patricia Smith. She's director of the Allen County Museum in Lima, Ohio. And again, welcome to our new listeners there from WGLE.